You're listening to the weekly teaching podcast of Willamette Christian Church in Westland, Oregon. We hope that what you hear today inspires you to laugh, question, think, and grow. If you'd like to connect with us even further, hit us up online at willamette.cc or shoot us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy this week's episode.
Well, good morning, everybody. As Brandon said, my name is Grant, and I just want to welcome you this morning to our service, especially those that are maybe watching online or listening to it later on in the week. We have so many great ways and opportunities to just stay engaged with the church, even when we can't make it on a Sunday. And so it's my privilege this morning to continue on in this series called Close Encounters. What we've been doing is all summer long looking at a different character of Scripture, mainly Old Testament characters, and looking at them and saying, okay, they had a close encounter with God. God met them. What is it that God taught them? How did they interact with God? What was that close encounter like, and how can we learn from that? So we launched this series on Father's Day. We looked at Moses that week, and then we looked at Gideon and then Jacob, and last week Dan did a great job of walking us through the story of Isaiah and his close encounter with God. And this morning, we get to look at the story of Hannah. The story of Hannah is found in 1 Samuel chapter 1. And what we're going to find when we go there and look at Hannah's story, we're going to see that Hannah had learned to trust God in the season of not yet. That Hannah had found herself in a season that she didn't want to be in. She found herself a part of a group of people that she really didn't want to be able to identify with. It was the season of the not yet. And in the middle of this difficult time in her life, she learned to trust God. Maybe you've had a moment in your life where you find yourself in the club of the not yet. It's a club that nobody really chooses to be in. It's a club that we don't want to be a part of. And yet we find ourselves in the club of the not yet. Sometimes it happens when you're a kid. Right, you're a kid, maybe you've got a big brother or a big sister, and you, all of a sudden they get their driver's license. And so now they have some freedom that you don't have. And you're like, I want to be in that club. But you're not old enough yet. And then they go on into high school, right? And all of a sudden, their curfew starts getting later and later and later. And they get to come home later. And you're like, I'd like to come home later. And your parents are like, not yet. Not yet. You're in a club of the not yet. It's not your time. And then you finally graduate high school and you realize that the club of not yet doesn't stay from when you're younger. It moves with you into college. Or maybe that's assuming you go to college. Maybe your club of not yet was that you were applying to all of these colleges that you wanted to get into. And all of your friends were getting accepted into the colleges of their choice that they desired to go to. And yet you couldn't get into the college that you really wanted to go to. And all of a sudden, this thing that you had on the horizon for you, you found yourself in a place that you didn't want to be. Or maybe you did go to college and you're going around and you're making friends and you're living the college dream and loving it until you start noticing that all of your friends start dating people and then they start getting engaged to one another and you find yourself being invited to a lot of weddings, attending a lot of weddings, being at a lot of wedding parties, but never being the bride or the groom. And then life continues on, and now you find yourself in an age where you're going, wait, I didn't think at this point in my life I would still be single. I'm in a club that I don't want to be a part of. And yeah, you can tell me, and I understand that there's a beautiful theology of singlehood and that we need single individuals in the church, and you can tell me that, but the yearning and the desire that is deep inside of me, it hasn't gone away. I don't like the club that I'm in. Or maybe you got married and marriage was going great and things were moving along and then you decided that, hey, it's time to start having kids only to find out that in your family you struggle and you're going to wrestle with infertility. And so this dream that you had of having children all of a sudden seems to get taken from you. And you're going, well, wait a minute, I have this desire to be a mom. I have a deep longing to be a dad and I can't. Like, what do I do with that? That's not a club that I ever wanted to be a part of. And yet I'm in that club. I don't know what to do with that. Maybe for you, it's some sort of medical thing. Maybe you were in an accident or maybe you're just getting older and you're starting to see people and they're doing things that you can no longer do. And it pains you because it reminds you of some realities of life that you have to live in and wrestle with. And you're now sitting in a club that you didn't want to be in. Or perhaps it's a career. Perhaps it's a career move that you made or that you didn't make or the promotion that you didn't get or the pay raise that didn't come your way. And you're in your mid-40s now and you're going, this is not what I thought. I thought by this point that I would be running my own company, that things would be going better for me. And yet I just got laid off again. This is not what I'm supposed to be doing right now. And we begin to look around and we say, well, why them and why him and why her and why not me? And we begin to ask the question of why is this happening to me? Because nobody chooses to be in the club of the not yet. Remember a time in my life, career-wise, where there was just some things going on and I felt like this desire had been put in me for some stuff and God had sort of wired me and I was like, this is on the horizon. I can see it. I can almost taste it, but I'm not getting to do what I know I'm supposed to be doing. I remember just wrestling with God and going, God, why not? I see peers around me that I went through school with and friends and colleagues, men and women that are doing exactly what they set out to do. And God, I'm not getting to do that. Why are you leaving me over here? This doesn't make sense. This morning, if you're in a season of not yet, I really simply want you to know that you're not alone. No, we've all been there. We'll all be there again. And God loves you in that season all the more. You being in that season is a reflection of God's care for you. The question for all of us is, what do we do in that season? What do we do when we're in the club of the not yet? How do we wrestle with that? And that's what we're going to see in Hannah's story this morning. We're going to see Hannah learn to trust God in the midst of a difficult time in her life. So if you have your Bibles, you can go ahead and open them up to 1 Samuel chapter 1. We'll be there in just a minute. If you don't have them, the words will be beside me on the screen here. But to give you a little bit of background, Hannah has grown up as a good Jewish woman. And she's married a man named Elkanah. At least that's how we're going to pronounce his name this morning. Elkanah. And she's married to him, and he is a Levite living in Ephraim. Israel at this point is scattered about, and so he's from the tribe of Levi, but he's living in Ephraim. And being from the tribe of Levi, that makes him a priest. Makes him this godly man that is supposed to put forth the sacrifices at the temple, and he's supposed to lead his community in what it looks like to follow after God and to submit to him. And so she's married to this godly man. But when I know, if you've been in church for any amount of time, if you hear the word priest, the Levite tribe is a priestly tribe. Maybe you have an image of something like this, that this is what a priest looks like for you, right? All dressed up and in their garb and looking fancy. The thing is Elkanah, he wasn't a priest in a metropolitan area. He wasn't a priest in an area where there was a large city and a large congregation. They lived out in the country, out in the sticks. He was a man of the earth. He was a little bit back country. And so when I think of Elkanah, I like to think of somebody more like this, right? Like this is a priest I can relate to. Like I can get on board with this kind of a guy and go, yeah, what does he have to teach me? And so Hannah's married to Willie here, and she's married. And then, but the story, it doesn't go the direction that we think it's going to go. Look in verse 2 with me. He, Elkanah, had two wives. The name of the first was Hannah, and the name of the second was Peninnah. Now, Peninnah had children, but Hannah was childless. You see, that right there in verse 2, we find the pain point that Hannah's living with. She's married to this great priest. And yet she's not able to have any children. You see, for Hannah growing up as a good Jewish girl, she would have desired and longed to grow up and to marry a Jewish man and to have a family and to provide heirs and sons so that the line of this man could pass on to the next generation and the next generation. It would have been a longing that was put in her early on, an identity that she could live into, that she could be a part of and breathe in. It was a part of who she was. In fact, most scholars believe that she was the first wife. Because being the first wife, like he loves her. She's the wife of Elkanah's youth. We'll see that in a minute where he provides for her in ways that he doesn't provide for his other wife. But as soon as it's found out that she's barren, that she can't provide children, he goes and takes a second wife in order to prolong his bloodline and lineage. And this was a common thing to do in their day and age. But here Hannah finds herself stuck. By no doing of her own, by no consequence of her own, she's stuck in a way that she doesn't want to be. She does not yet have children, and so she's a part of a club that she never desired. Maybe you've been there. And maybe you know someone that they had something in them that they knew they were destined for, that they were dreaming for. And maybe as a kid, you wanted to be a firefighter or a policeman only to try again and again to get into the academy and you couldn't. Or maybe you wanted to be a CPA or a lawyer, but every time you sat for the bar, you failed the test and you couldn't get in. Or you had this dream of being a pilot only to fail the eye exam and never get to be one. You see, there's different areas in life where we grow up and have these longings in us that then when we get older in life, they don't come true. And we're stuck going, wait, this isn't how life was supposed to be at this point. Story goes on in verse 3. Year after year, this man, her husband, would go up from his city to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh. It was there that the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, served as the Lord's priests. So year after year, Elkanah would take his family and they would go to Shiloh. They would go to Shiloh in order to make sacrifices. Now Shiloh, it means place of rest. So they would go to this place of rest in order to make a sacrifice. What you need to understand about that is they're living in a day and an age before Jesus has come. You see, Jesus came fully God and fully man, and he lived a life that none of us could live. And when he went and died on the cross, it was a sacrifice on your and my behalf. Because before that, what would happen is the Jewish individuals that were following Jesus, they would go on a regular basis to the temple and they would make a sacrifice to God. And they would sacrifice a young lamb and they would repent of their rebellion against him and then leave that place with their heads held high saying, God, we are going to serve you better in the future. And so for generations, the sacrificial system was in place until Jesus showed up and said, I am the sacrifice once and for all, which gives me now the freedom to walk forward with my head held high, knowing that Jesus has paid once and for all. But that hasn't happened yet. And so Elkanah takes his family to Shiloh. And every time they go, they would go and make these sacrifices. In this place, Shiloh, it's supposed to be a place of rest. But as we're going to see with Hannah, it was anything but a place of rest. Look at verse 4. Whenever the day came for Elkanah to sacrifice, he used to give meat portions to his wife, Peninnah, and to all of her sons and her daughters. But he would give a double portion to Hannah because he especially loved her. Now the Lord had not enabled her to have children. And while she's there, her rival wife used to upset her and make her worry, for the Lord had not enabled her to have children. Peninnah would behave this way year after year. Whenever Hannah went up to the Lord's house, she would upset her so that Hannah would weep and refuse to eat. So finally, her husband Elkanah says to her, Hannah, why do you weep and not eat? Why are you so sad? Am I not better to you than even 10 sons? You see, Hannah would go to Shiloh that was supposed to be a place of rest, and all it did for her was become a reminder and where she would be confronted with her greatest shame, her greatest disgrace, her greatest disappointment. Maybe you have seasons like that where you're in this club that you don't want to be in, and yet there's holidays that come, and every time Mother's Day comes back around, it's a reminder to you that you don't have kids, or every time Christmas or Easter or a Thanksgiving comes around, it means you're going to have to go face family and answer the same questions over and over of why the expectations that they've put on you of what your life should look like doesn't match yet, and it should be a time of celebration, but you dread it. You see, when we're in those seasons of not yet, there's these calendar events that come around that should be times of rest and celebration, but instead, they are horrible reminders to us. We dread going because it reminds us of how our life isn't the way it was supposed to be. We did something to mess it up, or the cards just didn't come in our favor. They didn't fall in the way that we wanted them to fall. That's what Shiloh becomes for her. And when we're in those seasons, those seasons of not understanding why we don't have with this deep desire that is in us. I think there's a couple of things that happen that we saw in this text. See, the first thing that happens is good intentions of other people hurt. If people come in and they have good intentions. They really are trying to help. They really are trying to be a balm, but instead they come in and they hurt you all the more. That's her husband, Elkanah. He comes with good intentions. He goes to the temple. He makes the sacrifice. He grabs the meat from the sacrifice. He comes back. And to the wife that can give him children, he gives her the normal portion. But to Hannah, he gives a double portion, as if to say, Hannah, I love you double. Hannah, the fact that you can't give me an heir is of no concern to me. I still love you. Here, let me show you that. But instead, every time she sees the double portion, it's just a reminder that she only gets that because she can't provide children for Elkanah. Not only that, but he looks at her at one point and he says, why are you so downcast? Like, aren't I better than 10 sons? And the rhetorical answer is, not at all. No, you're not better than 10 sons. And guys, if you're a husband in the room, you can understand this, right? There's times where we try to do things to comfort and to calm, and instead we just make it worse. Right? And Elkanah, he gets a bad rap sometimes, but he genuinely is trying to help. He's genuinely coming to her and saying, listen, I love you. And she's like, right. But the longing to have a child is so deep within me. It is so the desire of my heart. It is such a pain point for me that Elkanah, nothing you ever do could fill that void. The pain isn't going away with anything that you do. There's one author that I read that said that at this point, it's as if Hannah felt like she was a pencil without any lead. She knew what she was created for. She knew what she was supposed to do. And yet every time you click the end of that pencil, no lead came out. She felt worthless. She felt like she couldn't really give what she was desiring to give because she couldn't provide an heir. You see, Hannah's hit a spot where she's not just feeling a little disappointed in life. She's feeling disjointed. Maybe you've been there. Or people are coming to you and they're going, hey, what you're going through, it's not that big of a deal. Like, it's just a little setback, a little disappointment. And you're going, no, it wrecked my entire world. I don't know how to live with this anymore. How do I go forward with this season of not yet? I don't want to be here anymore. I can't think of maybe any other better time where people come and they have good intentions and they say things that they mean to help, but they actually hurt, than when you're single and going through a breakup. Like, if you're going through a breakup, you know what I'm talking about. Because people come in those moments, and we've all been there where they come and go, hey, you know, everything happens for a reason. Yeah, that's not helpful right now. Like, this just hurts. Hey, you know, there's plenty of fish in the sea. Yeah, but I want to be with that fish. Like, if I was concerned with the other fish in the sea, then this wouldn't hurt so much. Like, I like this fish. I'm attracted to this fish. Those fish are ugly. Like, I want this fish, right? Like it's not helpful there. Or, hey, you know, and I've heard this, you know, I never really liked him anyway. Jeez, thank you? Like, how is that supposed to make me feel better in this moment? Hey, you know, this, it was bound to happen sooner or later. No, it wasn't. You could have told me that ahead of time. Like, what do you mean by that? Hey, I know this hurts right now. I know you're going through a breakup and it's not fun, but you're still so young. As if there's some magical date out there when all of a sudden you hit a certain age where it's no longer okay to be single. They don't say that, but man, that's implied. You see, family and friends, they come to you all the time with good intentions, but they hurt deeply. And when you're in a season of longing for something in the future that you can see but you can't grasp, people come and they try to help you, but it's just a stark reminder of how broken you really are, or at least how broken you feel. But that's not the only thing that we see. You see, because what happens next is life begins to mock us. Everywhere we look, we see that everybody else is in the club that we're not in. Because when you're in the not yet club, you begin to see how everyone else is enjoying it. And you see it all over the place. Not only that, but right, the rival wife, she comes and she begins to belittle Hannah and speak into her and pour onto her. And she literally mocks her in these moments. Because when you're in a season of not yet, that is when an antagonist loves to come in. That's their playground. They love to come in and just remind you of all the ways that they're better than you, and that if you would just do what they are doing, then your life would be better just like theirs. But I don't even need an antagonist to come in. I'm good at doing that myself. Right? Maybe you've had that moment when you're in the season of not yet and you go to sleep at night only to wake up in the middle of the night and to have the tape play over and over and over again in your head of all of the ways that your life isn't what you thought it would be. And you begin to hear those lies and you begin to hear those things and you begin to believe them. And you go, you're right, I am a screw up. I did mess up. There's no hope for me. I can't go forward. And that tape plays over and over and over and you become your own worst enemy. And then if you can go back to sleep, you wake up the next morning only to all day recognize all of the places where you mess up over and over and over. And it's confirmation bias. And you just begin to go, see, I just can't do it. As you can do, I'm never going to get out of this spot because I can't do it. Why do we do that to ourselves? Like, I don't ever wake up and go, today I'm going to focus on my pain. Like, that, I don't want to do that. If I had the choice, I would stop doing that. And yet, it's what we do when we are in these tough and difficult seasons. I think part of the reason we do it is once you're aware of something in your life, you begin to see it all over the place, maybe even in places where you shouldn't see it. maybe to demonstrate this in a somewhat silly way, is to talk about automobiles. You see, when my wife and I first got married, as I've shared with you, I drove a four-door Jeep Wrangler, stick shift, loved that thing. It was great. And then we eventually sold that and traded it in for a Honda Element. And I loved my Honda Element. It was such a great car. It was black. I loved that car. And then I got a little ambitious. I decided, you know what? I want something different. And so I bought a 1989 Jeep Grand Wagoneer. It was beautiful. It was gorgeous. Silver paint, wood paneling. It was awesome with the like maroon carpet everywhere. The original family SUV. I loved that car. Took really good care of it. When I bought it, it had 80,000 miles on it. I was the third owner. But then you see what happened is my wife and I started to have kids. And we had another kid and another kid and another kid and another kid. Yeah, we started to have kids. And so all of a sudden I looked up and my Grand Wagoneer, which in 1989 was a great family vehicle, was no longer a great family vehicle. It's not 1989 anymore. So I sold that. And I'm proud to tell you that if you see me cruising around town right now, I drive a 2012 Honda Odyssey minivan. Thank you. That's right. I am a minivan dad. And I'm actually proud of it. I kind of like the rocket ship. It's fun. I'll drive it around. It's blue rocket ship. I'll drive it around anywhere. I'm a minivan dad now. Like that's the season that I'm in. And I embrace it somewhat wholeheartedly, right? It's a great car. It really is. And I thought I was totally fine. I loved being in the minivan dad club until a couple of weeks ago. See, a couple of weeks ago, I was hanging out with a buddy of mine in Colorado. And we began, as you kind of do, just talking about, like, what is your dream car? And he goes, man, my dream car is a microvan. And I was like, dude, I've heard of micro machines. What's a microvan? Like, I don't know what that is. And so we pulled up on the Google machine what a microvan is, and he started showing me all these pictures, and I was like, dude, that is awesome. I've never heard of that. I've never seen those before. In case you don't know what a microvan is, okay, this is a microvan. Right now, that's a dad minivan right there. Like, I could get on board with that. I could cruise that around and still feel like I've got my cool points, okay? Like, this is a cool minivan. And I saw that. I was like, man, that's what I want. I want that. I'd never heard of them before. I came back. I flew back here. You know, it's been about a month since I had that conversation. You want to know what I see all the time now as I drive around? Microvans. I see them everywhere. Apparently, a lot of people drive them. This is a thing here in hipster Portland land area, right? Like it's a deal that like people drive this. But here's the thing. I didn't know they existed. I passed them on the road all of the time. I never even noticed them until I became aware of them. And now I see them everywhere. That's how life mocks us. That when you are in the not yet club, because of the pain that you feel, you begin to see where everyone else is in the club that you want to be in. And you begin to put people in a club that aren't in the club because you see things that you never saw before that maybe aren't even there. But man, it feels that way, doesn't it? Because when you're aware of it, you see where other people are succeeding where you are not. So people try to help, but they hurt, and life begins to mock us, which means we need to do exactly what Hannah does. Look with me at verse 9. On one occasion in Shiloh, after they had finished eating and drinking, Hannah got up. Now at the time that Eli the priest was sitting in his chair by the doorsteps of the Lord's temple, she was upset. And so she prayed to the Lord and she was weeping uncontrollably. Have you ever been there? Have you ever been so distraught, so emotional that somebody just asks you a question and tears just flow from you? It's uncontrollable. You can't stop the weeping. It just comes out. That is the dire state that she is in. She was so upset that she begins to weep uncontrollably. But in this moment, she makes a vow to the Lord. O Lord of hosts, if you will look with compassion on the suffering of your female servant, remembering me and not forgetting your servant, give me a male child to your servant, and then I will dedicate him to the Lord all the days of his life. His hair will never be cut. You see, in this moment, Hannah, in her distress and her pain, she begins to cry out to God. She says, God, would you meet me here? I have a plea and a petition. You see, I think what we need to do when we find ourselves in these seasons is speak our pain to God. We have to go to him and say, God, I'm going to speak this pain to you. I'm going to cry out to you. Hannah is still broken. She is still upset. And yet she goes to God and says, Lord of hosts. Scholars would be quick to point out that this time that she calls him Lord of hosts, it's the first time in scripture that name is used of God. that Hannah is going, God, I see you. I know you sit on a throne and you rule, and people come in to your room and they ask pleas and petitions of you, and they ask things of you, God. And being a good and loving God that sits on your throne and loves your people, loves your creations, loves them like your children. You are a good God that wants to give them good and amazing gifts. God, if someone asks for a piece of bread, you're not going to give them a stone. And so God, I'm here calling on the Lord of hosts to give me what my heart longs for and desires. So much so that this title, Lord of Hosts, would be picked up on in the Psalms, chapter 57, verse 2, where it would say that I will cry to the God Most High who performs on my behalf. Think about that. Your Creator loves you so much that when we are in the season of the not yet and we come and speak boldly to Him, He listens. And Scripture says that He's willing to perform on our behalf. That takes a sort of bold brokenness to do. And that's what we see with Hannah. She's boldly broken. She's broken to the point that she knows she can't do it on her own. There's nothing in her that could ever provide this. She needs God's help. And yet she is bold enough to go to Him and declare to Him, God, I know who you are. And so would you give this to me? God, I am crying out. I am begging you in this moment. She speaks her pain to God. And it's right there that her focus begins to shift. It moves off of her circumstances and on to the God that can do something about her circumstances. She's still barren. She's still without child. But she begins to shift her focus a little bit as she cries out her pain to God. I don't know why in our culture and society, maybe you grew up in a church like this that didn't give us permission to take all of our hurts and pains and emotions to God. I think that's a disservice to a God that loves us so much. That when you cry out to Him from the depths of your being, He knows the emotions. He gave them to you. And that's what Hannah does. And in that moment, she shifts. But here's what happens. You know this. You've lived this. That as you begin to shift your focus back onto God, that's when really quickly you can get derailed again. That's when that negative dialogue begins to kick back in. And this is what we see in verse 12. As she continued praying to the Lord, Eli was watching her mouth. Now Hannah was speaking from her heart. Although her lips were moving, her voice was inaudible. Eli therefore thought she was drunk. She's crying out to the God in these words that we read of hers. She wasn't saying them out loud. It was this core of her heart. She was just screaming from her heart to God, so much so that her mouth begins to mutter the words. And Eli looks at her and thinks that she's drunk. And so he comes over to her. And the next verse, it says this. So he said to her, "How often do you intend to get drunk? Put away your wine." But Hannah replies, "Oh, that's not the way it is, my Lord. I am under a great deal of stress. I have drunk neither wine nor beer. Rather, I have poured out my soul to the Lord. So don't consider your servant a wicked woman, for until now I have spoken from my deep pain and anguish." You see, she shifts and she goes, I don't no longer have to speak out of pain and anguish. I can speak out of confidence in who God is and what He has done, which means she's gotten out of the negative mindset that she was in. You see, if she was still in the negative mindset, then what would have happened is she's in the temple pouring her heart out. And Eli does what he'd probably done dozens of times. He'd seen someone in the temple that appears to be drunk, and he goes over and asks them nicely to leave. And he'd probably done that over and over. And so he goes to her. And in that moment, if Hannah is still in the negative mindset, then she doesn't respond boldly with Eli. What she does is gets up and goes, "Oh, I know. I'm sorry. I mean, I haven't had anything to drink, but my life is just falling apart. And I want a child so bad and I can't, but I'm such a screw up. Like, I mean, here I am at the temple trying to pray and I can't even do that right. Like, I can't even pray right. You're coming and chastising me for praying, and there's just no hope for me." She would begin to play that negative dialogue over and over. Maybe that's you this morning. Maybe you came to church this morning because you're in a hard season. And you're there and you're going, I don't know what to do. And so, hey, there's this church and I'm just going to go to this church and see if God would meet me there. And you came in with hope of what God could do, only to have the service start and everybody stands up as if on cue, like they know some secret code that you don't know. And the music starts playing and they're singing songs, but you don't know that. And you look around and go, see, I can't even do church right. Oh, that God is meeting you in this moment. Put aside the negative tape that is playing. and find God in the moment, because what Hannah does is she steps out of shame and disappointment and into her strength and security of who God has called her to be. So much so that she can boldly look at Eli and say, no, I haven't been drinking. I haven't had beer or wine, which, let's be honest, when we're in times of stress, those are two things that we tend to go to before we go to God. Hannah goes to God first. And it so moves and changes Eli that here's what it says in verse 17. Eli replied, "Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant the request that you have asked of him." And so she said, "May I, your servant, find favor in your sight." So the woman went her way and got something to eat. Her face no longer looked sad. It's not just that her perspective shifted and changed. Her countenance did as well. She was able to change her perspective so much that she walks away. She eats food for the first time from the double portion that was given to her. It's no longer something that reminds her of her shame. She now sees it as the blessing and love that Elkanah meant it to be, and she can walk out with a smile on her face and her head held high. See, that's what an encounter with God does. It changes us. But the pain was alleviated, not in the fulfillment of her desire, but in the moment of her surrender. Don't miss this. The pain was alleviated, not in the fulfillment of her desire. She still longs to have a child, and she doesn't have one yet. She still longs to be a mother, and she's not one yet. The fulfillment, the pain didn't go away because she got what she wanted. The pain went away because she surrendered it over to God, which means that we don't have to wait on our circumstances in order to pursue a loving God that cares for us. It means that we can look at God and say, even with my existing circumstances, I know that you care for me, you love me. I don't have to wait on those to change, God. It's not going to be the fulfillment of the desire that is in me that gives me the hope or the future. It's surrendering everything over to you. That is what Hannah does. She gives it all over. So how do we then begin to live like Hannah? If we're going to have this sort of a close encounter, I think the first thing we have to do is speak. Right, that's what she does. She immediately just goes and pours her heart out to God and just speaks to him and has this encounter with him. We don't even know what God said to her necessarily, but she just pours out her heart to him, and God meets her in that moment. Maybe for you, you need to begin to pour out your emotions and your feelings to God. Maybe you need to write them down in a journal of some sort. Maybe you need to go on a long drive or go on a hike so that you can cancel out the noise and have an encounter with God so that he will shift your perspective, that you would go to him and say, "God, I feel like I should be in a different place professionally right now, but I'm not. God, I feel like my dating life should look different, but it's not. God, I should be the boss of this business, not that guy. Like, God, I want that desire. God, my kids should know better by now. Why do I have to keep parenting them like this? They're 32 after all. They should know better right now, by God. Like, why should I keep having to do this? Like, God, why does she get that and I don't get it? Why does he have it and I don't have it? God, why should I be living this way?" And you go and you're shooting all over the place, and God comes and goes, "Yes, speak that out to me. Share that with me. I want to hear that heart of yours." That we would begin to speak to God honestly, maybe for the first time. If this is where you're at as you leave today, there's a card that says "speak" on one side. On the other side is a great prayer to pray this week, to just begin to learn how to speak honestly with God. But as you do that, as you speak honestly with him, don't be surprised when God steps in and then asks you to yield everything over. And God says, "Hey, then I'm going to ask you to come and yield your dreams and your desires to me." When God comes in and says, "Hey, all of your opinions and your identities and your marriage and your divorce and your responses and your language and the things that you do and that you don't do, your individuality, your sexuality, all of the things that you do to define your life, give it over to me, yield it over to me and see what I can do." And here's what I'm here to tell you is yielding to God is never easy, but it's always worth it. It's always worth it because he can give us things that we never could have dreamed or imagined we could have. But we have to be willing to yield it over to him. We have to be willing to say, "God, this is yours." That's what Hannah does. Her prayer before God is, God, would you just give me this? I'm calling on the Lord of hosts to give me a child, but God, if you do, I will come. And after he is weaned, leave him at the temple to be raised up in the priestly line that is here. God, I will give him immediately back to you. She's willing to yield her son over to God. I told you there was a season in my life where I was wrestling through just this season of not yet. So I began to speak to God and we began to have a dialogue about this. And I'll never forget, there was this moment where I just felt the Holy Spirit come in and go, okay, Grant, here's my question. I've put this desire for you and you're having this conversation. Are you willing to continue to pursue that even if I don't give you the desire of your heart until you're 60? I was like, no. I want that now. Like, it's a desire of my heart now. I don't want to wait till I'm 60. Like, that's like, that feels forever away. Like that's half a lifetime for me. Like no, I don't want to do that. And God and I wrestled for months over this where I wasn't willing to yield that over to him. And finally, I got to a place of humility where I said, you know what, God, I'll give it to you. Yeah, if you don't give me that till I'm 60, I'm okay with that. You're better than the dream that I have. And because God is loving and he knew my heart better than I did, he goes, good. Now, what if I don't ever give it to you? Okay, that I'm not. No. God, we had a deal. Like, we've been wrestling with this for 6 months, right? Like, we had a deal. Like, when I'm 60, I get that. Now you're up in the ante and saying, I'm never going to get it. God, I'm not okay with that. And he said, what does that say about the kind of follower of me that you are? That you're not willing to let go of this dream. And I wrestled through that, and eventually I just came to a place where I humbly went, okay, God, if you never give it to me, but you keep the desire in me, I'm going to trust that the pursuit of that dream, while I pursue you within it, that I will find you along the way in ways that I wouldn't if I didn't pursue it. And so, God, I'm going to trust my future with you. I'm going to continue to pursue that. But if you never give it to me, I'm going to trust that that's for a reason that I don't understand. I'll tell you, to this day, there's things and there's dreams that pop up. And I'm like, man, would I ever have that? And every single time I go, maybe, maybe not. But I'm gonna just keep pursuing God in the process. Because you see, when you speak to God and then you yield over to him, it allows you to then go confidently. That you can walk around in life and every single time a new desire comes up and you look around and you go, I'm in the not yet club. That's okay. Because I'm leading with God and I'm following with him, and where he goes, I'm gonna go, and I can now go confidently and trust him. Because I understand who Jesus is and what he did for me. That Jesus came and he died on the cross and he rose again. And when he rose, that doesn't just give me a hope for the future. It gives me confidence right now. It gives me hope in everyday moment of life that when things are falling apart, I can go, that's okay, because Jesus dealt with death, which means he can deal with what I'm dealing with right now. Hey, God, this is yours. I give it over to you. God, how do you want me to lead in this? God, what do you want me to do? And I don't do it perfect all the time. In fact, a lot of times I screw it up. I have to follow through this pattern of, no, I don't want to give it to you. Fine, I'll give it to you. And then go confidently. Because that's what Jesus does for us, is he gives us the ability to do it. In fact, the text even alludes to Jesus in a really fun way. They got up early the next morning, and after worshiping the Lord, they returned to their home at Ramah. Elkanah had marital relations with his wife Hannah, and the Lord remembered her. And sometime after, Hannah became pregnant. She gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel, thinking, I asked the Lord for him. Hannah goes back, head held high, not because she has the child yet, but because she trusts the God that can give it to her. And then she goes and has a son, and she names the son Samuel. Now Hannah's story, it's tied up in a nice little bow. You and I aren't guaranteed that. Our story may not be tied up as clean and as nice as Hannah's is. But the subtle thing that's so beautiful in the text that we're able to know, because we have all of the Bible, Hannah didn't have. And so what we know is that this son Samuel, Hannah does exactly what she said. She takes Samuel and weans him and then takes him to the temple where he's raised under Eli. And Samuel, her son, becomes this great priest over the nation of Israel, really more of a prophet and a judge. So much so that, and he's such a godly man, that God gives him the ability and the right and the privilege to anoint the first king of Israel. That king rebels against God, and so God comes to Samuel again and says, I want you to anoint a second king, and that king is David. And as David becomes king and leads out his life, Samuel becomes the man in David's life that every single time David begins to turn away from God and thus bringing all of Israel with him, Samuel is the one that speaks into David's life. Samuel is the one that keeps David chasing after God. Samuel is the one that confronts David when nobody else will do it. Samuel becomes somebody that without him, there's no telling what would have happened in David's life. And David, he becomes the ancestor of Jesus. Hannah had no way of knowing that. She probably didn't even live long enough to see her son anoint David as king. And yet here we have the son of a redneck priest and a mother's heart crying out to God. And God comes in and does something that we couldn't even imagine with Samuel. You see, maybe in your season of the not yet, God is delaying and waiting because he has a different plan. He has something else going on and happening that you can't see right now, which is where the faith and the trust comes in. That we would say, okay, God, I'm going to have hard conversations with you about this. I'm going to yield things over to you, but I'm going to go confidently that you are working in ways that I don't understand. And so if you find yourself in a season of the not yet, I just simply want you to know that God loves people in that club and that you can trust him.